You are listening to a sermon by Carl Brown, recorded on Sunday, February 14, 2010, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Welcome here. If I don't talk loud enough, you can go to sleep. I'm always afraid that when I come to speak that it will be a memorable sermon. People tend to remember unpleasant sermons. They tend to forget acceptable ones. Does anybody remember anything I said in my last sermon?
Amen.
I appreciate the congregation's faith in me, that I might have something worth listening to, and I'm always warmed by the love and acceptance I feel from this congregation, starting with my singing. I often think that the best contribution I can make to the singing is to listen. Also, I am impressed because of the people we have here. We have Evan Kreider, professor of voice, a great singer. And where I usually sit, where Andre is, I'm singing almost directly into his ear. And he never gets up and changes his seat. For years I thought he must love me just that much. Turns out he's deaf.
I also sit beside her.
So you turn both of them off? Okay, this morning we listened to a reading from Exodus. And I don't have much to say about that, but I always get a chuckle when I read that part of Exodus because I have a Roman Catholic upbringing. And in the very early translations of this particular part of Exodus, the Hebrew says something like, light shone from his face like horns. They didn't have the word for rays of light. And because of this and the misunderstanding, a lot of the early Catholic icons, the paintings, portray Moses with horns. And to this day, we still have that showing up in movies because it's iconic. How many times have you seen a movie of some place that has a witch doctor or a wise man and he's wearing a hat with horns? That's where that comes from. It's amazing the misunderstandings that keep going on. And despite the number of topics that I could have chose, I chose something else. I mean, we have Transfiguration Sunday and Valentine's Day and the Olympics, which I know nothing about. The only thing I would like to say about the Transfiguration is, and it does tie in with Valentine's Day, is years ago, when I was a boy, they had British Sunday Theatre. Does anybody remember British Sunday Theatre? Back when we had two channels? Nobody would watch television on Sunday, so they'd show all the British movies they bought. And this one was a very interesting story. It was about the end of the Second World War. A young pilot had survived a crash, and he was burned, and he was disfigured. And he was recuperating in a country house, which was owned by a young woman who was left to her. And she was very plain. She was, the movie depicted her as ugly. And these two ugly people were shunned by society because of their disfigurations, their unpleasant to look at faces. And because she had a house but no money, and he had a pension but no house, and it was the thing to do, they thought they'd get married. They didn't love each other, but it just seemed convenient. And after they got married, they fell in love. And the movie shows them one morning, they wake up in bed, and they look at each other, and they're beautiful. His face is healed. He's handsome. She's got a soft, lovely complexion and radiant. And they're astounded. And they get up and they get dressed and they go out. And they're treated by the community the same way. Nobody wants to look at them. Everybody's rude to them. So it turns out that in this story, it's just because they love each other. And it's a wonderful story. And I think it's a story worth mentioning today on Transfiguration Sunday and Valentine's Day. Okay, now we'll talk about the sermon. So now you can just get cozy, lean against somebody. A young friend of mine and I were having lunch together. Now, he's an engineer. He grew up with parents who were renovators for heritage houses, so he knows about craftsmanship. He had his own little workshop when he was growing up in the backyard. He almost burnt it down 3 times. Just that kind of kid. He knows that things won't work well if they're poorly made or poorly designed. He can design things that work and that don't break under normal usage. He knows when to make things strong. He knows when to make things light. He owns his own company outright. He is a guardian of his own intellectual property. He's a good engineer through and through. And as you might expect, when two engineers get together, we were talking about technical problems and solutions. And he asked me a question. He said, "Why do engineers keep making the same mistakes?" And he wasn't talking about calculations. Some of you may remember when Metrotown was being built, they had a parking lot on top of Save-On Foods, and all of a sudden, cars fell through the thing. That was just a miscalculation. That wasn't a real mistake. That was a miscalculation. He wasn't talking about that. He's talking about bad engineering. He's talking about engineers design things that fail when they don't have to. They design things and they don't research them. They don't look at known good designs and use that. They just make something. And it doesn't work, and there's no reason for it, because there are good designs for that particular item out there. And he's always puzzled when he buys stuff, and it turns out to be junk. And he sometimes buys 1,000 items for his business, and he opens it up and they test them, and they break. He says, how can this be? You know, somebody sat down, put a lot of time and effort, and was paid money to make this thing work and to make it good, and it's crap. How come? He's just puzzled because he knows that there's no reason for this. Well, you and I know that there's nothing that can't be built more cheaply than something else, and of course, you can often buy a product that was well-designed, but it's poorly manufactured because people do it cheaply, and of course, we're all to blame for that, because if we didn't buy that, the company would go out of business, and everybody would know you can only build good stuff. But we all buy cheap stuff. That's the way humans are. If a product has been around for a long time, all the failures and defects should eventually be discovered and rectified. After many years of development, re-engineering all of the weak points, a product should be perfect. Should be. But my friend's question, why bad engineering? Why does it happen? Is one that's often on my mind. It's a case in point. Let me tell you or talk about a technology that everyone here has plenty of experience with. The flush toilet. Now, Andre could tell you all about how poorly some toilets are designed. He can literally talk to you for hours about this. Ask me how I know. Now, my experience. My sons have complained, and everybody else is too polite to say anything, about the toilet I presently have in the upstairs bathroom. saying it often needs to be flushed more than once to do its job. Other friends of mine, renovators mostly, have also complained that some toilets just don't work well. And they work, but sometimes you've got to flush them a couple of times. Why is this? Why is flush toilet technology not perfected? It's not like we don't make very many of them. There's billions worldwide. And this may surprise you. It's not like they're a new invention. Flush toilets have a long history. Evidence of them has been discovered as far back as the 26th century BC in what is now the western part of India. And they had an excellent, a very advanced sewer system as well. 26 centuries BC, two more centuries, we're talking about 5,000 years of flush toilet technology. Why doesn't mine work? Okay, if we can't come up with a good, simple, fail-safe design for a flush toilet in 5,000 years, where does that put us as engineers? Just to refresh your memory, this is a sermon. It's not really about toilets. It's about bad engineering and what it says about humanity. It's specifically about our readings from the Bible this morning and what they say about humanity. Why is there bad engineering? In my life, two out of the five brand new toilets that I bought don't work well. Two out of five don't work well. Why, after 5,000 years of design and manufacture, can't I buy a toilet that flushes perfectly every time? And why? Well, it's bad engineering. It's just bad engineering. People don't quite understand that it isn't just a bowl and you dump water down there. I mean, yeah, that's how it basically works, but there's so many little details. Hydrodynamics is very, very complicated. You have to have the nozzles just right to get the right pressure. They have to be facing the right way. They have to be the right height. The S-trap has to hold a certain amount of water. It's really very complicated. And it looks simple, but it's one of those things that is really deceptive. The details are what make it work. It's the details. Tiny, invisible details. You know, you can make one that works most of the time, like I have. But if you want one that works perfectly every time and doesn't use a ton of water, it takes a lot of design, a lot of development and testing. All right. So people build these things, and they work, but they don't work well, but they sell them anyways. And somebody else buys them and tries to retail them to somebody else, me. Well, okay, that's another old story again. That's a combination of salesman's greed and my desire to save a few dollars, right? So they work to the lowest common denominator and you have bad technology. Okay. So how is good engineering accomplished? It's a simple process, really. Mistakes are discovered and admitted. Flaws are isolated. And those flaws are corrected and tested. And then you repeat. You do it over again until it's perfect. It's not too hard. Every engineer knows this process. All right. Speaking of engineers, in 1977, back when I had hair, I used to work in Santa Clara, California. I was building these incredibly expensive machines. They were called computers. 1977 computers. Well, I saw, you know, you could probably have fit one in this room. Be a tight squeeze, but you could have done it. And these things, only corporations could afford them. You know, they were huge, big machines, very expensive. And I was working in Santa Clara, California. There's a lot of high-tech jobs there at that time, and a lot of engineers. And one of the guys who I used to run into at an electronics junk shop, Saturday mornings all the junk shops would open, and we'd go and we'd buy electronics stuff and build our projects. He was working on a computer that he hoped to sell to individuals instead of corporations. He was going to make it small enough and cheap enough so that people could buy it. He was going to call it a personal computer. And he actually was working on the second version. His first version had sold very well, but it had an odd problem. It only affected some users with some programs sometimes. And it was hard to track down because it wasn't always happening. He finally tracked it down. And on the second version of his personal computer that he was selling, he corrected that mistake. And he included with every computer a nice little documented blurb about his mistake in the previous one. Now, this is what I did wrong. This is what I did to fix it. He not only accepted the mistake and isolated it and cured it, he corrected it and told everybody about it. He didn't only follow these three steps. He was honest and forthcoming about it. This fellow's name was Steve Wozniak. He was the designer of the first Apple and Macintosh computers, and he's the co-founder of Apple. And he's a legend amongst engineers. And we call him the Woz. His last name is Wozniak. And he's famous for his good work and his integrity. Now, sadly, some engineers fail at this first step. They veil their mistakes. I'm going to read again Corinthians, and I'd like you to focus on the word veil in this passage. Therefore, since we have such a hope, we are very bold. We are not like Moses, who would put a veil over his face to keep the Israelites from gazing at it while the radiance was fading away. But their minds were made dull, for to this day the same veil remains when the old covenant is read. It has not been removed, because only in Christ is it taken away. Even to this day when Moses is read, a veil covers their hearts. But whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And we, who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. Veiling the truth. If you veil the truth, you fail at step one. Now, we have this concept, and everybody's probably heard of this, the concept of denial. When somebody is faced with the fact that is too uncomfortable to accept and rejects it instead, insisting that it's not true in the face of overwhelming proof, they will use one of the three forms of denial. Form number one, simple denial. They deny the reality of that unpleasant fact altogether. Doesn't happen. Didn't happen. Or they may go to step two, minimization. They admit the fact, but deny its seriousness. Or number three, a little closer, but still denial, projection. They admit both the fact and its seriousness, but they deny responsibility. And that sounds probably like a certain large automobile manufacturer that's been in the news lately. Mm-hmm. In fact, that particular item makes a really good example of bad engineering and failing at step one. People were complaining about the accelerator sticking, causing unwanted acceleration. The company's stages of denial over the last month has gone something like this. Doesn't happen. Just doesn't happen. Okay, so they're finally faced with proof it does happen. Enough people are getting proof together. They say, well, it does happen, but only when people kick the floor mats and they hit the accelerator. Well, they've now moved to, well, it does happen, rarely, but it's a simple problem with the linkage. People wear the linkage out. Well, the truth is hard to pin down, but many critics are now saying this is a problem with the software, the computer program in the car. Those of you with some mechanical experience probably remember you press on the gas pedal, it pushes a lever, which opens up the carburetor. That doesn't happen anymore. My son's working at a company that's doing electric car conversions, and he's taking apart this brand new car. And he hands me the gas pedal. And I look at it, and it's this big piece of plastic. It's got a hinge, and there's nothing connected to it. I says, how does this work? He says, oh, you plug the wire in here. I said, the wire? He says, yeah. Yeah. The gas pedal just has a little sensor, and the computer looks at the gas pedal and where it is and says, it's halfway down. Let's feed half the gas to the engine. There's no connection. So there's a computer in there. And many critics are now saying that it's a software flaw with the computer. And this company is saying, no, it's not. The reason why? Because software is very hard to fix. Just to give you an example of how difficult it is to play with software, a good team of four engineers could create a brand new computer in a month, bring it up to production stage in a month. Whatever computer you've got on your desk at home or whatever, four good engineers, starting first of the month, by the end of the month, they could have it ready for production. The operating system that goes into it, like Windows or OS X or something like that, that takes, and we've got good information base, takes 10 times the engineer, at least 10 times the engineers. That would be very, very low. At least 12 times as long to create the operating system, to write that software. Software is very difficult to write and to debug. When you write one line of software, it works out that if there are 10 commands in there, 4 of them are wrong. These are statistics. And you have to test it and test it and test it. Software is tested by writing it, sending it out to your customers, and having it come back failed, and then you fix all of it. Anybody hear of software updates? Mm-hmm. Okay. So now we have an idea of what's going on here. If they have to admit that it's software, it's not the same thing as, you know, saying, oh, well, this little part here, we just have to give everybody new little parts here. It's easy. Mm-hmm. They have to try and figure out all the possible ways this could possibly fail and what could be causing it. And it's very difficult to change as well. So we have denial. We have a company trying to place a veil over a problem. Who will lift the veil? Critics lift the veil. Now, critics could be people, could be the government, could be the law. Critics, well, we're supposed to be self-critical as well. Critics provide the first part of the engineering cycle. They lift the veil. Some examples of critics. My upstairs toilet. My sons criticize it, thankfully, because others are too polite or embarrassed to talk about it. And it's not something that fails all the time. But they're not going to put up with it, because they're going to talk to me about it. They're critics, and they're thankful for that. The auto corporation with the brake problem. Well, in this case, this is not the unwanted acceleration problem. This is the brake problem. They've got other problems as well. Sometimes you step on the brake, nothing happens. Well, they've been denying that. And finally, the Woz himself, the co-founder of the Apple Corporation, who had bought one of these cars, he's actually had 10 of them, he went on national television and detailed the problem, even stating that he had a method for demonstrating the problem with 100% repeatability. He was a critic doing his best to unveil a problem, getting the problem to step one. And the accelerator problem, different situation, that's not a happy story there. Police evidence showed that a fatal accident occurred with a runaway accelerator case while the floor mats were in the trunk. In this case, it was the law lifting the veil. Now, this isn't, believe it or not, a sermon about engineering. It's not even a sermon about my upstairs toilet. This has all been, of course, a metaphor. The engineering stories, while long, are just the vehicle for the metaphor. The tenor of the metaphor, the actual case of the metaphor, is how we lie to ourselves, both as humans and as Christians. This engineering cycle isn't just an engineering cycle. It's the cycle that we humans use to improve ourselves and each other. We use it all the time. We use it to train children. We use it to correct the faults of those we love. We use it to change our own bad habits. And our biggest problem is step one, lifting the veil, looking under denial, admitting there is a problem. Now, from our reading in Corinthians today, we can read how we should be. We should be turning to Christ to take the veil away from our eyes and see our own flaws and stop lying to ourselves. And then to accept the freedom, the word freedom is in there, and I think it stands out quite pointedly. To accept the freedom to admit where we've been wrong and transform our own lives while we're still here on this earth. Denial is a defense mechanism. That's well understood. Sometimes there are truths which we cannot accept, so we deny them. And the critic's blessing is to remove the veil of denial from our eyes, to allow us to see the flaws so that we can isolate them and correct them. A good critic, one we can trust, one we can accept criticism from, is precious and rare. There may be no perfect critic, but a good one would be close to me, love me enough to take the risk involved with criticizing me. A good critic would be thoughtfully persistent, care about me enough to keep trying, encourage me to get through my denial. And number three, most important to me, give much thought to criticism. My faults are numerous and my ego is small. I really can't stand to hear about all my bad faults. I would say, please hit me over the head with only the very worst ones. Give much thought to criticism. So a good critic would be close to me, be thoughtfully persistent, and give much thought to criticism. A good critic is precious and rare. In the search for the truth, my critic is my greatest ally. So, in closing, let me just read again 2 Corinthians. Just a part of it. And I am going to annotate it. Therefore, since we have such a hope, we are very bold. We are not like Moses, who would put a veil over his face to keep the Israelites from gazing at it while the radiance was fading away. We won't try to hide our failures. But their minds were made dull, for to this day the same veil remains when the old covenant is read. It has not been removed. We tend to think if we've done something the same way all the time, that's good enough. Because only in Christ is it taken away. Even to this day, when Moses is read, a veil covers their heart. But whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Christ has let us look at ourselves. He encourages us. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. It is amazingly freeing. It's a wonderful, lightening feeling to be able to say, I was wrong. You were right. I was wrong. You can drop all that defense, and you can concentrate on fixing things. And we, who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. May this happen to all of us.